Thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Lori. And hello, everyone. It's really nice to see you on this Sunday evening. As you may know, of course, I'm going to be sharing from the Seven Steps to Awakening now for about an hour. And then at the top of the next hour, we will begin our Awakening Together member meeting. So I hope you can hang around for both. What I would like to do, just as an opportunity to be still before the teaching starts, is play a song. I think, if I'm not confused, which I could be confused, but I think that this evening might be the first evening of Hanukkah. I could be confused. It could have been yesterday, but I think it's today. So what I thought I would do in honor of Hanukkah is just go ahead and play a Hanukkah song. Yeah, it is today. Okay, that's what I thought. You know, I get confused because I'll glance at a calendar, and then I don't remember if I glanced at that calendar today or yesterday or if I was looking at tomorrow. So I knew I saw it somewhere around there when I glanced at the calendar recently. But I thought I would play a Hanukkah song then in honor of this wonderful first evening of Hanukkah for those who celebrate Hanukkah. So this song is called Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah.
Each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Oh, Hanukkah, oh, Hanukkah, come light from the north. Let's have a party, we'll all let's go for a gather round the table, we'll give you a treat. So for the need to play with the lock is to eat. And while we the candles are burning low. One for each night they shared a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Once for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago.
All right. Yeah, I love that song. It's very lively. But also, I think I mentioned to you all that nearly every one of the songs on my holiday list has a message in it. And this song talks a lot about celebrating Hanukkah in a very playful way. And then it says, and while we are playing, the candles are burning low. And what those lines really remind me of is while we're doing whatever we seem to be doing in the world, that subtle truth is always present, always here. And we can turn our attention from our involvement in the world to the subtle reality, the subtle truth, the subtle presence in any moment because it's always here. So that's what those lines remind me of. And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. The subtle reality is always present. All right. Well, again, welcome. Welcome. Oh, wow. I see some people here that I don't usually notice on Sunday evening, so it's kind of nice to see some of you all here in the room that aren't usually here, I don't think. So I am going to be starting tonight with 686 in my Seven Steps journal. And I'm putting a link in the room. There we go. There's a link to 686. This is a quote from the Yoga Vasistha. And those of you who were here last week know now that that is a scripture called the Supreme Yoga in English, the Yoga Vasistha, a scripture. So this is a quote from the Yoga Vasistha. So long as one does not subdue the mind with the mind, one cannot attain self-knowledge. And as long as one entertains the false notions of I and mine, so long sorrow does not come to an end. I mentioned to you all that I read from the Quran this morning. The Quran arrived here yesterday. I ordered it recently. The reason that I ordered the Quran was because in January, on Wednesday nights, I'm going to start hopefully facilitating here in the sanctuary a Sufi contemplation group. And I'm hoping that some of you all, if not all of you all, will come and join me at least for the first one to check it out and see what you think of it and see if it's worthwhile for you. It will be held on Wednesday night, so the first Wednesday night in January, it will be held at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I had to go back into my memory. So the first Wednesday night in January, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and then every Wednesday at 7 after that. But if you come to the first one and check it out, that would be a lot of fun. But anyway, this is why I ordered the Quran. So I was reading the Quran this morning. And I only read like about the first three or four pages. That's all the further I got. But the message that I saw in the Quran at the beginning was basically the message of Allah speaking to Muhammad and to everyone through Muhammad, saying, I have brought you the messages of truth many times through many prophets. And many times you have said that you understand, and yet you do not live the truth. And another message that I saw in the first few pages is that as long as we persist in not living the truth, so will suffering persist for us. And some of that same message is right here in 686. So long as one does not subdue the mind with the mind, one cannot attain self-knowledge. And as long as one entertains the false notions of I and mine, so long sorrow does not come to an end. It's that very same message. You know, we hear the truth so many times, and because we are attracted to it. You know, we hear it in teachings that we listen to. We hear it as we read scripture or books that point toward truth. We hear it within our own heart, within our own mind when we're in contemplation. And yet, we still entertain the ego. We still entertain the ego. And by the way, when I share messages like this, I am not sharing these messages to say that we are guilty or that we are bad or that we are lacking in some way. In fact, such a message as that would still be to entertain the ego. I merely share these messages just to bring our awareness to the opportunity to become, as A Course in Miracles would say, even more vigilant for the kingdom. An opportunity to become even more vigilant for the kingdom. We can continue to become vigilant for the kingdom until through some miraculous shift, being vigilant for the kingdom is natural. And then I don't know if you would call it vigilant anymore. But what I mean by that is just naturally there is no attention going to ego at all anymore. In fact, maybe there is not even ego in the mind anymore. Who knows? But until we are at that natural space of no attention going to ego at all anymore, we can always become more and more vigilant. And sometimes that vigilance just needs to become more and more subtle, right? Many of us, when we start looking at how we entertain the ego, we are looking at those very painful thoughts. We are looking at our thoughts of guilt and unworthiness. We are looking at our thoughts of attack. We are looking at our anxiety, our fear. We're looking at those ideas that seem to develop into emotions that cause us to suffer. And that's a wonderful place to start. In fact, I think until the mind has been healed of what I call the I am bad thought, I think there are so many messages that are shared with us every day that we misinterpret through that I am bad thought, that I think healing the I am bad thought is a wonderful place to start, a wonderful place to start, and worth our complete focus until we no longer believe that idea anymore at all. But even when some of these stronger ideas that really seem to cause a lot of suffering, even when they seem to be healed, by healed I mean we no longer believe them, we're no longer interested in them, they don't grab our attention anymore. Even when they seem to be healed, if we continue to pay attention, we find subtler and subtler forms or subtler and subtler ways that we continue to give attention to ego. And so it seems like there's always additional opportunity to become vigilant for the kingdom. It's just that that additional opportunity seems to get easier after some of these key wrong ideas are healed. It gets easier. We don't have to struggle. In the beginning, it seems like there's a bit of a struggle in letting go of false beliefs. At some point, it's not a struggle. They just have to be noticed. But the vigilance needs to continue. So when I look at this quote, and let me read the quote to you again. So long as one does not subdue the mind with the mind, one cannot attain self-knowledge. And as long as one entertains the false notions of I and mine, so long sorrow does not come to an end. When I read that quote, what I hear is a call to become vigilant if we are not vigilant. And if we are vigilant to some degree, to see if we can't up the ante, as they say, and become even more vigilant. Again, without any judgment, without any guilt, without any negative strain or negative energy at all, but purely out of our heart, out of our heart desire for truth, out of our heart desire for self-realization, out of our heart desire not to be fooled by falsehood anymore. So let me look and see what I wrote in the journal when I first contemplated this quote. 686A. Mental awakening is not reality. However, mental focus, discipline, and coaching are necessary on the path of awakening from mind. Do not listen to this advice with the mind. Listen with the wisdom of heart. Mind is helpful on the path of awakening, just as it is helpful on the trail into illusion. One cannot avoid mind as long as mind has not been transcended. However, there is a helpful or corrective aspect of mind. Number one, learn to discern between mind that points toward truth and mind that consistently points into the forest of illusion. Number two, abide by the guidance of corrective mind. And number three, use any means helpful. Use any means helpful to disengage from the illusion-promoting aspect of mind. And so that's 686A. I'm going to read the quote again from the Yoga Vasistha. So long as one does not subdue the mind with the mind, one cannot attain self-knowledge. And as long as one entertains the false notions of I and mine, so long sorrow does not come to an end. All right, so 686A says, mental awakening is not reality. And I'll tell you what I mean by that sentence. You know, people use the word awakening to point to different events. I don't know what other word to use. Different events on the spiritual path. For example, let's imagine that a person is very, very hurtful in their beingness as a habit. You know, maybe they grew up in an abusive home or something, and this is what they learned, and they're very hurtful. They hurt, you know, their significant other, either physically or with words or both. They hurt their children physically with words or both. They hurt their coworkers. I'll say with words, or else they would be fired probably. they hurt their coworkers with words, and of course, you know, they hurt themselves with the thoughts they believe about themselves. So a person is just hurtful. It's kind of the habit that they learned in this lifetime, and it's the habit they live with. And then at some point, for some reason, maybe they hear something, maybe they dream something. Maybe they see something. But all of a sudden, for some reason, it dawns on them that this hurtful energy is just causing so much suffering, and that their heart does not want to continue to live in this hurtful energy habit anymore. They really don't. They see that they don't. Maybe they even break down and cry because they just see so much they don't want to continue to live in this pattern. And they begin to seek help in whatever way they seek help. Some people call that point awakening. They'll say that I had an awakening. And you know what? That is an awakening, isn't it? It's a very important shift. It begins to change the entire pattern of how they lived. And then, you know, another way that sometimes the term awakening gets used is, you know, people study spiritual materials, whether it's Advaita, whether it's A Course in Miracles, whether it's, you know, the poetry of Rumi, you know, whatever it is, they study. And for a long time, and I'm sure many of you had this experience, for a long time, although something in them is certainly saying that this material is very valuable and very true, there's a struggle in them, and you could call it a struggle to understand. You know, there's something in them that's still blocking the true understanding of the material, and they know it. They know it. They know that they don't fully understand yet, and they continue to study, and they continue to contemplate, and they continue to listen to teachers, and, you know, they do whatever it is they need to do as they search for this understanding, and maybe some of it gets through, but yet they just know something is missing. And then one day, there's this click. I mean, I remember the day my click happened. I remember exactly the day it happened. One day there's this click. And all of a sudden, everything they did not understand before when they read it or when they heard it, now they do. They understand. They really do. And many people will call this point awakening. This point is what I call mental awakening. And just like the first awakening that I described was a beginning, the beginning of the search, this second awakening is also a beginning. It's really the beginning of the opportunity for true practice. Up until then, although there may have been some practice, the practice was limited by the fact that true understanding was still blocked by the ego. But once that true understanding comes, once that light dawns, there's such a deep understanding of what spiritual practice is and what's being accomplished through spiritual practice, and such an understanding that just wasn't there before, then now there's also an opportunity for practice that wasn't there before. This mental awakening is a wonderful, wonderful new beginning. But it is not reality. It's another starting point. And so that's what I'm referring to in this journal entry, where I say mental awakening is not reality. When that click happens and that understanding dawns, mental awakening is not reality. However, mental focus, discipline, and coaching are necessary on the path of awakening from mind. So you could call it the struggle that we go through prior to the mental awakening. The struggle to understand, the seeking. You know, many people put seekers down. But what this is saying is, no, that seeking is necessary on this path. That period of seeking is necessary. And then once the mental awakening occurs, there's continued mental focus and discipline and coaching that is necessary. Because even though understanding has dawned in a big way, and now everything that is read, everything that is heard, results in what I would call immediate clarity. There's no longer confusion when reading a teaching or confusion when hearing a teaching. Not once mental awakening happens. Everything results in immediate clarity. The ego is still present. Even though this awakening of understanding has occurred, the ego is still present. And so the ego, in spite of the understanding, the ego still has the ability to distract us from the heart and to lead us to believe the resistance in whatever way the resistance shows up for us. I am too busy for this spiritual practice, or that tends to be my way resistance shows up, which is why I went to it first. I am too busy. But I know that there are other ways that resistance shows up. Even if you have nothing to do, I'm sure you have your resistance stories that show up, and you're as familiar with them as I am with mine. And so because the ego still has the ability to capture our attention and lead us to believe resistance, believe I don't want to for whatever reason, we still need to be mentally focused. In fact, what I find one of the most helpful things for me, maybe the most helpful thing for me, actually, to help place me in the heart so deeply that resistance doesn't have a chance with me, is contemplation. This is why I value contemplation so much. Whether I'm contemplating the Quran, as I did this morning, or whether I'm contemplating the 7 steps to awakening, or whether I'm contemplating the teachings of Inner Ramana, when I'm contemplating something, I drop into the heart. It opens the heart. However you want to say that, the experience of the heart becomes so rich that resistance, ideas of resistance, cannot capture my attention. And so I often begin my day with contemplation, because then I'll be able to move more easily without this wall of resistance capturing my attention. So that's the way that I focus. I focus through contemplation. But you know, I need the discipline. If the contemplation is going to be my water slide into the heart, I still need the discipline to make sure I go to the contemplation first. You know, the mind may say, well, do this. Okay, now just do this. Okay, now just do this. Okay, now just do this. All right, now just do this. Has me accomplishing all of these little tasks. And before I know it, you could say it's too late in the day. I have a class that I really do have to teach or something like that. And it's too late in the day now for my contemplation and then the meditation that follows. So if I want to go to the contemplation, which will naturally lead into the meditation, I need to have the discipline to go to that contemplation very quickly in the morning. And coaching. Coaching can come internally or externally. Every now and then, not real often, but every now and then I'll receive a bit of coaching, either sent directly to me or sent to a few people by Michael Langford. And I find every time that I receive the coaching from him, I don't think I can express how motivating it is. I find the coaching to be very, very motivating. You know, think about if you were learning track or learning some sport. And, you know, it's one thing to jog around the track every day by yourself and, you know, you're trying to get faster because you're on a track team, or to swing a bat every day and you're trying to hit the ball better because you're on a baseball team. But, you know, when the coach gets in there and starts coaching you, it can be extremely motivating. There's something more motivating about having the coach, even if the coach says the exact same thing that you already knew. There's something extremely motivating in the partnership with a coach. And I find that I have two coaches. You know, on the outside, the apparent outside, there's Michael Langford. But then I also have the inner coach. And the inner coach speaks to me every day through contemplation, which is two reasons for me to contemplate, because I get the inner coach. And I get that same motivating factor from the inner coach if I start my day with contemplation. So even after the mental awakening happens, again, what's wonderful about the mental awakening, you know, when you've reached the mental awakening, because you really stop asking questions, you just understand. You understand at a way that's beyond words, the spiritual teachings, and you don't have questions. When the teacher speaks anymore, you don't get confused. It doesn't matter what words they're using. It's all clear. It's all easily clear. But the mental focus, the discipline, and the coaching remain necessary because the opportunity for resistance is still present. And so the opportunity for vigilance remains even beyond the mental awakening. The clarity is not the end of the journey. It's the beginning of a new journey. So 686A starts off with, mental awakening is not reality. However, mental focus, discipline, and coaching are necessary on the path of awakening from mind. And then this says, do not listen to this advice with the mind. Listen with the wisdom of the heart. And I even have that in italics. And so I am certain that on January 10th, 2013, when I wrote that, as I was contemplating that day, the ego was also attempting to whisper something. And I don't remember what the ego was attempting to whisper. But when I was saying, do not listen to this advice with the mind, I was putting the ego's whispers aside, even as I was contemplating. Listen with the wisdom of the heart. And I just don't recall what the ego was saying, so I will just move on. But I know what you're looking at there is live coaching. If you're looking at the journal with me, I was coaching myself right then, during the contemplation, because the ego was attempting to hijack this contemplation. Mind is helpful on the path of awakening, just as it is helpful on the trail into illusion. That's kind of an interesting sentence. Mind is a tool, is the way that I interpret that. Mind is a tool. And the tool can be used in two different ways. The tool can be used to take me deeper into illusion if I still have interest in that. That doesn't make the mind bad. It actually makes it a very useful tool. If I want illusion, it will take me there. But the same tool can help me towards awakening. For example, if I get up in the morning, and usually I do spend a few minutes on the computer just to wake up after I get out of bed, because if I, you know, I just want to wake up enough that I can go into contemplation. So I will do things like post the daily quote, maybe post any announcements that came out on the Awakening Together update. If there's a really simple, fast email that doesn't require really diving deeply into work, you know, I might deal with that. I'm drinking coffee while I'm doing this. But at some point, there's this feeling of what I'm going to call done. Done with that wake-up period of time, that wake-up, which is what I was doing, that waking up physically. I'll feel this is done. And then there will be some thought. You know, like maybe to, like this morning, the thought was to go in the kitchen and get the Quran. I had opened it. It had come on Saturday. I had opened it and left it laying on the kitchen counter. So the thought was to go into the kitchen and get the Quran and read the Quran. Well, that thought is mind, is it not? All thoughts are mind. But that thought was mind pointing in the direction of truth, pointing in the direction of awakening, pointing in the direction of take your contemplation time now. So just like that tool can be helpful by taking me deeper into illusion, tool can be helpful in pointing me in the direction that goes towards awakening, in the direction that follows the heart. So mind is helpful on the path of awakening, just as it is helpful on the trail into illusion. One cannot avoid mind as long as mind has not been transcended. However, there is a helpful or corrective aspect of mind. And then I wrote three instructions. And I think, you know, just based on my experience, I always find that teachers kind of teach based on their own experience if they're teaching, if they're not teaching intellectual teaching from a book. Teachers always teach from their own experience because that's what they know. And in my experience, a very, 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 very important first step on this spiritual path was learning to discern between what A Course in Miracles calls the ego and the Holy Spirit. If I cannot discern between the wrong mind and the right mind, I do not know when to let go of the thought and when to listen to the thought. So one of the very first things that I really need to come to know is the difference between what we call the ego and the Holy Spirit, or what I call in this journal entry, learn to discern between mind that points toward truth and mind that consistently points into the forest of illusion. Step one. And then step two, abide by the guidance of corrective mind. And what's not stated in step two, but but it would be absolutely necessary if you're going to abide in the guidance of the corrective mind, would be not to listen to the mind that points into the forest of illusion. Every time you recognize it, don't listen. Every time you recognize it, choose to let it go. Every time you recognize it, see that as ego that you do not want. Every time you recognize it, realize that is just conditioning. Right? And just let it go, let it go, let it go. And then number three, use any means helpful to disengage from the illusion-promoting aspect of mind. Oh, there it is. It is stated. It's just stated as number three. Use any means helpful. Any means helpful. So I've told you all that for me, what is helpful is very quickly after arising in the morning, you know, after having just enough mental activity to really wake up well, to go directly into contemplation, followed immediately by meditation. This right now is most helpful to me. It hasn't always been, right? There was a time when journaling, writing was most helpful to me. Also, as I've gone along this path, there have been different materials at different times that were most helpful. You know, in the very beginning, it was Peace Pilgrim. And then it became A Course in Miracles. And then it became NTI. And then it became those messages that came when Laurent and I were together. And then it became the teachings of Inner Ramana, right? And then it became the Seven Steps to Awakening. And then it began to broaden to include many things so that each day, you know, like I grabbed the Quran today, I don't know yet what I will grab tomorrow. Just many, many materials, all to me saying the same thing. What's important is to know what's helpful to me now and to embrace that. Truly embrace that. Love that. Want to spend time with that just as much as I might want to spend time, for example, with a man that I'm falling in love with. You know how when you're falling in love, you want so much to spend time with the man or the woman that you're falling in love with. You know, your mind just naturally thinks about them all the time. You might even annoy your friends by how much you speak about them. You don't have to make yourself remember them, right? Because you're falling in love. I think it's really helpful to allow myself to fall in love with whatever is most helpful right now. Fall in love. And so that's the way that I like to use any means helpful to disengage from the illusion-promoting aspect of mind, is by falling in love with whatever is, with what is helpful now. Maybe that makes me a little bit Sufi. I think the Sufis like that path of falling in love as well. Maybe that's why I'm going to be leading the Sufi contemplation circle. Maybe I'm a little bit Sufi. What's that song? A little bit rock and roll. A little bit country, a little bit rock and roll. Right? I'm a little bit Sufi. All right, so 686A. Mental awakening is not reality. However, mental focus, discipline, and coaching are necessary on the path of awakening from mind. Do not listen to this advice with the mind. Listen with the wisdom of the heart. Mind is helpful on the path of awakening, just as it is helpful on the trail into illusion. One cannot avoid mind as long as mind has not been transcended. However, there is a helpful or corrective aspect of mind. Number one, learn to discern between mind that points toward truth and mind that consistently points into the forest of illusion. Number two, abide by the guidance of corrective mind. Number three, use any means helpful to disengage from the illusion-promoting aspect of mind. And so now I'm going to continue to 686B. Just as a reminder, the quote that we are looking at now is from the Yoga Vasistha, and it says, "So long as one does not subdue the mind with the mind, one cannot attain self-knowledge. And as long as one entertains the false notions of I and mine, so long sorrow does not come to an end." All right, 686B. Remember that the root cause of illusion and all suffering is the belief in a distinct self. Any idea that de-emphasizes the self or de-emphasizes I, me, mine is a helpful idea and one worth listening to. I'll read that again. Any idea that de-emphasizes the self or de-emphasizes I, me, mine is a helpful idea and one worth listening to. Watch all ideas that emphasize the self and be willing to let those ideas go as unnecessary. So ideas that de-emphasize the self. One of my favorite ideas that de-emphasizes the self is who am I or what am I? It comes both ways for me at different times. Who am I? When I ask that question, who am I? It de-emphasizes the I, me, mind. It results in an immediate shift to awareness. Who am I? Another thought that is very helpful to me is the mantra that comes from the teachings of Inner Ramana, I am that I am. And I may have mentioned before that all I really need to do is say, I am, and the memory of the entire mantra comes into the mind, and the entire mantra doesn't need to be stated, just I am. But what it really means is I am that I am. And you know, people often say, what does that mean, I am that I am? It means... I am I'm trying to figure out how to say it in a different way because I've become so clear on the meaning that I'm looking for different words. It means, this is poor English, it means I is. And you could also say it means I am. Because, this is a little bit weakening it, but I am because I is, right? I am because I is. It's like someone saying, who are you? And you say, be, you know, be. I am be, or I am being, or I am is. I am that I am. And so, when you say the mantra, I am that I am, you shift away from whatever personal identification the mind was just dishing out. Another idea that is helpful to me is be still and know that I am God. But really, all I need to say is be still. And to some people, the word be still sounds like a command, almost like you're telling the mind to shut up. But be still does not sound like a command to me. Be still is a reminder that moves the attention from the mind to isness to awareness, to beingness, to the heart. It just moves the attention. Barb is saying rest. Rest. And I remember when I, much earlier on the spiritual path, you know, like in the first 2 or 3 years, the idea that came to me most often that was extremely helpful was actually relax. In fact, I think maybe the very first time or one of the first times that I heard words from the Holy Spirit, what I heard was relax. Relax. Yeah. So these ideas that come are to be listened to, obviously. You know, obviously. And that's really what 686B is saying. Remember that the root cause of illusion and all suffering is the belief in a distinct self. Any idea that de-emphasizes the self is a helpful idea and one worth listening to. But then, of course, watch all ideas that emphasize the self and be willing to let those ideas go as unnecessary. And those ideas that emphasize the self can be what we would call positive or negative, right? So, for example, the thought, I'm such a stupid idiot. But I want to emphasize, what happens is we get distracted by the stupid idiot and we forget to notice the I. See, that's really all that sentence is doing, is emphasizing the I. I'm a stupid idiot, right? The same thing with I'm so smart. We get distracted by the smart, we feel good, and we don't notice the I. I'm so smart. You see? I'm fat and ugly. We get caught on the fat and ugly and we're distracted away from the I. Oh, I look so good. We get distracted by the look so good and we forget the I. But you see, there's no difference between I'm stupid and I'm smart. I'm fat and ugly, or fugly, as my cousin used to call it. I'm fugly, or I look good, because they both equally emphasize the I. So whether we notice our mind chattering about how stupid we are or how smart we are, it's an equal opportunity to maybe say, who am I? I am that I am. Be still. Rest. Relax. Right? They're all equal opportunity to step away from the mind. So remember that the root cause of illusion and all suffering is the belief in a distinct self. Any idea that de-emphasizes the self, the I, me, mine, is a helpful idea and one worth listening to. Watch all ideas that emphasize the self and be willing to let those ideas go as unnecessary. And that takes me to 687A. 687, in this book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, this is the quote. In the twinkling of an eye, this little ripple known as the mind assumes terrible proportions. Man foolishly ascribes to the true self the sorrow and the sufferings that do not touch it in the least, and becomes miserable. I'm sure we've all experienced how in the twinkling of an eye, this little ripple known as the mind assumes terrible proportions. You know, like we're happily doing something, maybe we're happily at work, working along, and the boss or a coworker comes up and says, what were you thinking when you submitted this report? Boom. You know, what we don't see right away is that I'm so stupid thought. Right? I'm so stupid. And immediately the mind is assuming terrible proportions, maybe depending on our conditioning. Maybe we're focused on how guilty and stupid we are. Or maybe we're focused on what a jerk the boss is, doesn't appreciate me. But either way, the mind, you know, went from happy to assuming terrible proportions in a nanosecond, right? In the twinkling of an eye, this little ripple known as the mind assumes terrible proportions. Man foolishly ascribes to the self, and that's the true self. Man foolishly ascribes to the true self the sorrow and the sufferings that do not touch it in the least and becomes miserable. How do we foolishly ascribe to the true self the sorrow and sufferings that do not touch it in the least? I think we do that with the word I. When we say, I'm suffering. I feel so guilty. I feel so bad. I'm so angry. I'm so jealous. I'm so whatever. Because what we are, what our true I is the true self. You could say we're kind of assuming that the true self is suffering. But actually, this is just projection. Projection away from what we are to an idea, I, as what we are. Let's look at 687A in the journal. If you let in one thought that comes to reinforce ego, ego is reinforced. More thoughts will follow, each stronger than the first. Attention is pulled in by belief once interest has been given. Although one's thoughts appear interesting, it is most helpful to stay in touch with one's true interest. When one remembers the interest and calling of the heart, especially when one remembers this interest and calling with the heart, mind's thoughts do not hold as much interest. So attention, a good way to describe attention is that it's just an extension of awareness. I mean, if you just play with me for a moment here, just for a moment, give me your attention. I don't know if you were looking at Facebook or talking to someone in the room or just listening to your own thoughts, but if you could for a moment, please give me your attention and listen to my words very carefully. Actually, do you notice that all that's happening is that you're now aware of me? Maybe you weren't fully aware a moment ago. Maybe you are aware of Facebook, aware of your own thoughts, right? But when I said, please give me your attention, you became maybe aware of me. And now I ask you, give your attention to your feet. I don't know if your feet are on the ground, if your feet are up on a footstool, if your feet are crossed, if your feet are in shoes, if your feet are in socks, barefoot, but just give your attention to your feet. Give your attention to your toes. Wiggle your toes and give your attention to your toes. You see, when you give your attention to something, you just become aware of it. So there's not really a difference between attention and awareness, right? You're just noticing with awareness when you give attention. So what 687A is saying is that when a thought comes in, like the boss comes up and says, how could you have submitted a report like this? And that thought comes in, oh, I'm an idiot, or I'm in trouble, or the boss is an asshole, or whatever thought comes in. And we give that thought our attention, right? That's what is meant by ascribing to the self the sorrow and the sufferings that do not touch it in the least. We give our attention to it. Our attention is an extension of reality. And therefore, we are feeding an idea with the isness of reality. And we begin to experience that idea as if it is real. And, you know, one way that we experience that is, again, with emotion. We just now dropped very quickly from happy to upset in some way. Another way we experience that is more thoughts come in along the same line. more thoughts telling me how stupid I am or how guilty I am, or more thoughts telling me what a jerk the boss is and how the boss doesn't appreciate me, right? And this experience begins to happen apparently to what I am. And so this fools us into believing that we are something that can be affected, instead of noticing that we are the untouched awareness. If you let in one thought that comes to reinforce ego, the belief that I am this person who can be affected, ego is reinforced. More thoughts will follow, each stronger than the first. Attention is pulled in by belief once interest has been given. Although one's thoughts appear interesting, your thought, you know, that the boss is a jerk appears interesting. Even, unfortunately, your thought that you're stupid or that you're guilty appears interesting. It is most helpful to stay in touch with one's true interest. When one remembers the interest and calling of the heart, this is called leaving your purpose in the front of your mind. Remembering what you truly want. When one remembers the interest and calling of the heart, especially when one remembers this interest and calling with the heart, mind's thoughts do not hold as much interest. So it doesn't matter if the thought that comes in is that I'm stupid, or if the thought that comes in is that the boss is a jerk. If I remember what I truly want, which is truth, if I remember I am not interested in falsehood, I can see either one of those thoughts as just ego bait. I can see either one of those thoughts as an untrue idea, and I can let it go. And I can give my attention to my boss in a different way. For example, I might, without any defensiveness or any anger, say, "Why, what was wrong with the report?" And be ready to listen now. Right? I'm going to look at 687B in the 2 minutes that we have left. When I forget my true self and become interested in the mind's thoughts, I experience the effects of that interest. So again, if I listen to the thought, I am stupid, I am guilty, I'm going to experience those effects. I'll experience that emotion. I'll experience that upset. If I listen to the thought that the boss is a jerk, I'm going to experience that anger, that annoyance, that impatience, whatever comes. When I forget my true self and I become interested in the mind's thoughts, I experience the effects of that interest. And what experiencing the effects of the interest does is it leads me to continually believe that I am this person rather than the untouched awareness. And actually, I'm going to move right on to 687C because that was pretty simple. 687C is quite a bit longer. Let me read it and see if reading it is enough or if I need to start here next week. Probably start here next week. 687C. How does the mind suck me in? So this is Regina now looking at Regina. After contemplating 687 and really understanding the meaning of it, now turning around and looking, okay, where are my weak areas? Where am I still easily sucked in by the mind? So this is what I wrote. How does the mind suck me in? Number one, thinking I need things a certain way. Number two, thinking I need to be perceived in a certain way. Or number three, thinking I need a certain experience. And I'm going to stop there. But these are three ways that I saw then that if these ideas arose, I would still get sucked in the mind. And I will continue to share from 687C next Saturday night, and we'll look at this a little more deeply. For now, what I'm going to do, we have a quarterly member meeting starting in a moment, but I am just going to pause a little bit and take a break in order to shift gears by listening to a Christmas song. And so looking for what song is going to jump out at me, and the song that has jumped out at me is Do You Hear What I Hear with Martina McBride. So let's have a listen to her, and then we'll begin our member meeting. Wonderful.